Our next case is number 20-13722 Mercer versus Alabama Department of Transportation.
May it please the court. This is Barbara Wells on behalf of the appellant, the Alabama Department of Transportation. I'm joined with my co-counsel in making the arguments presented in our briefs. Those co-counsel are Mr. Brookshire, Mr. Patty, Mr. Byrne, and Ms. Williams. Today, this case presents three issues to the court, and they are somewhat inextricably intertwined. One has to do with the district court's failure to follow the applicable legal test in deciding whether or not fees were appropriate in a mixed motive case in which the same decision defense was the finding of the jury in relieving LDOT from liability for damages and the exposure to certain injunctive relief such as reinstatement. The next has to do with the denial by the district court of the motions that the LDOT filed for judgment as a matter of law in the absence of any evidence that the decision maker considered race in making the decision challenged relating to Mr. Mercer's dismissal from employment after his gross and continuous lengthy misconduct came to light. The last issue has to do with the admissibility of certain evidence that the district court allowed that went to a purported comparator named Shannon Golden. Mr. Golden's conduct did not rise to the level of an appropriate comparator under the test applicable when the district court decided the summary judgment motion, and the district court found counsel, that to be the case.
Counsel, yes, I'll start with the comparator issue because it sort of feeds into a lot of what follows, especially with regard to the judgment notwithstanding or judgment as a matter of law. Once you get past summary judgment, once we get past McDonnell Douglas, the ultimate question for the jury in this case was whether race was a motivating factor, correct?
Yes, sir.
Why is it not relevant? And on the sliding scale of relevance, we can dispute, but at least not relevant that someone who has similar characteristics, although doesn't meet the standard of a comparator under Lewis, was treated differently. How is that not a relevant fact? And let me just add to, before you answer, let me just add, haven't we said that it is, even where a comparator doesn't meet the test for McDonnell Douglas purposes, part of the tile of the convincing mosaic, as we've called it, that can be considered?
Thank you, Your Honor. Actually, I'm not familiar with the case that you are referencing that shows the 11th Circuit or any panel of the 11th Circuit using as a tile in a convincing mosaic rejected comparator evidence that doesn't rise to the level of sufficiency for the McDonnell Douglas burden shifting approach. Obviously, the district court here applies.
Isn't the whole point of the convincing mosaic that you can't meet McDonnell Douglas or don't, but that there is other evidence out there which suggests or at least creates an issue of material fact on the causation element, right?
Yes, Your Honor, that's true, but it's never been that we use stuff that doesn't rise to the level of a comparator and that didn't meet that test. And I would refer Your Honor to the core COAR decision cited.
I didn't understand that. I thought that the comparator analysis was one kind of analysis and convincing mosaic was a separate kind of analysis.
I think either are usable to establish a prima facie case, either the McDonnell Douglas or the convincing mosaic. The question here was, did the district court improperly use as a tile in the mosaic evidence that he knew to not establish Aristotelian similarity? The danger to confusion of the jury by offering
where is there a requirement of Aristotelian similarity? I mean, even Lewis didn't say that. But Lewis, the answer to your question, I think, is what case says that? Doesn't Lewis say that even if they don't meet the comparator standard, quote, evidence of their treatment meaning the difference of treatment is not irrelevant. In other words, it still meets a relevancy standard under the convincing mosaic, even though it doesn't check all the four boxes that's there for a comparator. I mean, let me ask it this way. Once you get to trial, you're governed by 401, right? The relevancy standard, 401 and 402. How is it not more likely to establish a fact that someone who is very similar to you, although does not meet all of the requirements that we've set out in Lewis, is treated differently, not relevant to how you're treated?
Well, first,
how does that not make it more likely than not that you were treated differently than that person?
Not when 403 comes into play and we're dealing with confusing the jury.
Ah, so that gets to 403. Okay, so.
And that was our argument in the motion in limine that was okay. Denied.
Cite me a case where we were reversed on relevancy grounds, excluded evidence, where a trial judge denies a 403. So a trial judge finds evidence to be relevant and chooses not to exclude within their discretion a 403.
I have not been able to find such a case,
right.
And nor have I been able to find a case where in this circuit, something like what the district court here did with respect to failed comparator evidence. And I encourage you to look at our chart on page 55 of our principal brief to show that these two gentlemen were not similarly situated in any relevant.
Counsel, I promise you, I've seen your chart as I've seen,
it's 50.
As I've seen your opposing counsel's distinguishing of that chart showing how they had the same ultimate supervisor that terminated them. They held a very similar position and both, at least at a high level, dealt with allegations of misrepresentation and fraud in what they committed. So I have seen that, but.
If I could disagree, Your Honor, just to say that the counsel, same ultimate decision counsel, maker was not in play.
Counsel, let's move past this for a moment and assume with me for the moment that I don't agree with you and I think it's relevant evidence. So what we have then is evidence of Golden, who is at least somewhat similar and was treated differently in terms of the discipline that was given. We have evidence of prior bad acts by Davis, someone who was in the chain of the decision maker here, and I won't go through them, but we all know what they are. We have that plaintiff was top rated at least before all this happened. We have that his African-American supervisor was not informed of the investigation into him, although everyone else in the supervisory chain was and wasn't sought input. And we have his testimony, which at least at this stage we take to be true because it's consistent with the jury's verdict, that he didn't do the things that were alleged to have been done. How is that collectively not enough to show that race was at least a motivating factor?
Your Honor, he also admitted the significant misconduct which justified the dismissal at various points during the trial. He admitted it, although he had previously denied it.
Did he deny, during his testimony, did he not deny that he, or did he say that he did in fact do every inspection that he said was done?
I'm sorry, I didn't follow the negative.
I apologize, that's an unclear question. Did he not testify that I inspected everything where I filled out a form that said I did the inspection?
But he also testified.
I'm asking you if he gave that testimony.
Yes, but he also admitted that there were forms completed on days when he was not inspecting plants.
Right. And had did he also did he also testify that he did in fact test everything that he said he tested?
No, he admitted that there were tests done in his absence.
Right, but they were done
by people who weren't certified or sufficiently skilled to do them.
And he also testified that he had permission from his supervisor to do that, correct?
He did testify to that, yes.
If he gave testimony that contradicts, despite the overwhelming evidence on the other side, isn't a jury entitled to believe that the reasons that were given are false reasons?
I think that to go back to something you put in the pile earlier that I'd like to address, the Davis evidence is particularly disturbing here because Davis isn't the ultimate decision maker.
Right, but he's in the decision making chain.
And there's no cat's paw. There's no cat's paw argument.
Counsel, he's in the decision making chain and he's the one who referred to Cooper, to Mr. Cooper, the ultimate recommendation to go forward with termination, right?
And had counsel for Mr. Mercer asserted a cat's paw argument at any point.
But counsel, this isn't a theory of liability. This is a fact of causation. The district court unappealed has allowed in rule 404B evidence of Mr. Davis. And all I'm asking is in adding up all of these facts, is it not enough to say that there was a sufficient evidence for the jury to find a motivating factor based on the fact that Mr. Davis treated his African-American supervisor differently than he treated all the white supervisors,
I'll stipulate to that if I can get, for the purpose of my 2 minutes left, to my principal argument, to the argument that requires this court to reverse and render on the fee issue, which is really what the court should focus on, if you will allow it, Your Honor. I'm down to less than 2 minutes.
Go ahead.
Thank you. So here we have a case where the district court clearly applied 10th Circuit law with a presumption that the 11th Circuit and binding precedent has rejected. The district court did not apply the test as the 11th Circuit and every circuit other than the 10th Circuit to consider the issue has said it should be applied. We need to be looking at proportionality. There's no discussion of the facts that go to proportionality. There's no discussion of the mountain of evidence of the plaintiff's misconduct in this case. There's no discussion of the paucity, albeit perhaps the court sees that issue differently about how much evidence there is of race discrimination with respect to this particular decision. This is not a case where there was any injunctive relief that was appropriate. The injunctive relief that the plaintiff pursued below would not have changed anything about the workforce or the relationship between the plaintiff and the employer, because that relationship was at an end and he was just looking for something of his own, which is this certification issue that the district court ultimately rejected. So When you analyze all of the relevant factors under Knupp and the cases like it, except for Gudenkauf from the 10th Circuit, which is out on an island, this is not a case in which attorney's fees were appropriate. The attorney's fee award in this case sets the unfortunate precedent as a matter of policy of creating a situation where the attorney has more to gain from the fee award argument than the employee in a case where the defendant is clearly found to have been acting appropriately because of employee misconduct. And at this point, I thank you, Your Honor, for letting me get that 2 minutes in.
Judge Pryor, is it okay if I ask a couple questions?
You may.
Thank you. Counsel, show me where in the order I have it in front of me where the court uses the term presumption.
when he quotes Gudenkauf and says that for may to have meaning.
So my question was very specific. Can you show me where he used the word presumption?
I'm so sorry. He did not use the word presumption.
Show me how many times he used the word discretion or may.
I cannot count those quickly enough to have any time left for my rebuttal, but I will concede he used those words.
Okay. Did he also not say the evidence here was substantial? That the jury found a substantial motivating factor?
Which that very sentence, Your Honor, is one I would point you to, because if you look at the form that the verdict signed, substantial is not in that question.
I understand, part of his job under Knupp is to evaluate the evidence. Did he not do that?
But there is no discussion of the evidence, and there is a misrepresentation of what the jury found. That sentence is,
he says,
the jury found.
Counsel, he says, I sat through the trial. I sat through days of trial. He's now written a number of orders in regard to this case. He says, my view is the evidence is substantial. We may disagree with that, but we can't say that he didn't analyze the very factor that Knupp told him to analyze, can we?
We can say that when there's no discussion of the facts that go to those factors.
Where did Knupp say to analyze the amount of evidence in support of something? I don't see that as one of the factors that Knupp says to consider.
The proportionality test that is adopted from the Shepherd case has to do with considering both the severity of the wrongdoing and also whether it's an innocent plaintiff.
Right, so if motivating factor is substantial, that goes to the severity of the wrongdoing, as opposed to if it was a minimal basis for firing, right?
Your Honor, I agree with you that the judge could have said, I found the evidence of that to be substantial. What he said instead was the jury found, and the jury didn't find substantial. It found a motivating force. That's what the verdict form says.
Let me ask.
Thank you very much.
Can I ask one final question on this, which is, so you started by saying that if we disagree with you, I'm sorry, if we agree with you on the attorney's fees issue, that we would reverse and render on that. Why wouldn't the better thing to do on that would be to just vacate and remand so the district court could apply the appropriate test.
It certainly is within your purview to do that. I submit that when you have the factual, detailed factual analysis that Judge Gray Borden did when he was asked to do a report and recommendation, he applied the test, concluded that under the Canup standard, there should be no fee. You have what you need to reverse and render and spare Judge Proctor another written opinion in what has been a very heavily litigated case.
Thank you, Ms. Wells. Because you are answering the court's questions, we'll afford you your full 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for Mr. Mercer. Mr. Clemon, you may begin when you're ready.
May it please the court, I'm UW Clemon. As the court knows, when the district court has acted on a request for attorney's fees in a mixed motive case, the question is whether it has abused its discretion. That discretion is very broad, and nobody really questions the latitude of a judge's discretion in that regard. LDOT doesn't, as it can't, question that discretion. But what it says is that the court applied the wrong legal standard. Now, let's first talk about the right legal standard, and that's Canup. And Canup says two things. You have to look at plaintiff's degree of success in obtaining the declaratory or injunctive relief, and secondly, the facts of the case. Degree of success, facts of the case. Now, in handing down Canup, our circuit relied heavily on Judge J. Harvey Wilkinson's Fourth Circuit decision, the Shepherd case. Now, under Canup, neither the degree of success nor the facts of the case is dependent on the other. Put another way, the degree of success is not the be-all and end-all of the judge's analysis under Canup. The ending may be quite different from the starting. The district judge has been mindful of and obedient to the Canup standard from the time that this case became a mixed motive case through the issuance of his decision in the case. He referenced it in his first order, distinguished it from Gutenkopf. In referring the case to the magistrate, he directed the magistrate to be guided by Canup. He gave deference to it again in his order awarding fees. LDOT's misapprehension arises out of its misunderstanding of Canup. If you look at its main brief, it says that the second prong of Canup is widespread or intolerable racial animus or unacceptable employee conduct. You look at its reply brief, it says that it's the relative culpability of the plaintiff's conduct, if any, and the severity of the defendant's conduct. To be sure, both of these factors should be considered, but they are not the second prong of Canup. The second prong is the facts of the case. Now, if there any doubt about it,
let me ask you to address this, because I think that's a great point. What do you see as the facts of the case, this particular case, that warranted attorney's fees, and where do you see the district court talking about those facts in its order?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question. The court analyzed the relative culpability of Mercer and LDOT when it adopted the findings of the magistrate judge. And the magistrate judge concluded that there was evidence of wrongdoing on both sides. But the uncontradicted fact is that it was LDOT's own wrongdoing that led to seven incorrect or falsified records out of more than 180 days of those reports. Mercer, the supervisor of the department, had a man who did nothing but inspect plants. In August of 2011, that inspector, Hightower, left the department. Instead of having three employees, Mercer had only one, and that one couldn't inspect plants. And so Mercer was saddled, in addition to all of his other responsibilities, with the responsibility of making plant inspections. LDOT knew that the department was overstaffed. It consistently ignored the constant requests of Mercer's direct supervisor to staff the department. And it was only after it fired Mercer that it acknowledged its deficiency, because it then suspended the employee, Brian Davis, who should have properly staffed the department. In addition to the culpability issue, the court looked to these unique factual considerations. First, in this case, a public employer, the road and bridge building arm of the state of Alabama, fired a Black supervisor for conduct much less serious than that of a white supervisor.
When you say, Judge Clement, when you say the court looked at that, I just don't see that in Judge Proctor's decision. Are you talking about Judge Borden's decision, the magistrate judge's decision?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Judge, in the report and recommendation of the magistrate judge, he recites the evidence that we say justified the relief that we sought, and I'm fairly certain that in that recitation, he recited the undisputed fact as I put forth that the department had not disciplined the white supervisor for more serious conduct than that engaged in by Mercer. That white supervisor was suspended for 30 days rather than discharged, where he had converted state property to his own use, used state employees for his own benefit, violating the state ethics law, and on his face, serious felonies, because intentional violation of the ethics law carries with it a punishment of up to 10 years in jail, as best I recall. The second unique circumstance is that the Black supervisor received no personal benefit from his misconduct. The white supervisor most assuredly did. Third, the EEOC, charged with enforcing Title VII, found reasonable cause to believe that this state agency had violated that statute. That remarkable finding is part of the record in this case. First, and this gets back to something that's been discussed earlier, the district judge found that Mercer's race was not simply a motivating factor in LDOT's decision. It was, based on his observations at trial, it was a substantial motivating factor. Finally, injunctive relief was denied on the concrete license revocation of Mercer, simply because Mercer was no longer employed by LDOT. But there's no question but that the license of the white supervisor, who admittedly falsified records, was left intact. No question but that Mercer is, and for the rest of his mortal life, will be precluded from working on any private contractor in Alabama who has a contract with LDOT. This sword of Damocles will be over his head for the rest of his life. These were the unique facts that the judge had before him and looked at.
What about the degree of success obtained by the plaintiff? I mean, it seems like that's another thing that when I look through Judge Proctor's order, I don't see any consideration of the fact that he was not going to grant an injunction, not going to give any meaningful relief to the plaintiff in the case. What do you say about that?
Yes, sir. Judge Proctor adopted the magistrate judge's report and recommendation. And in the magistrate judge's report and recommendation, he makes findings on the relative culpability. And he concludes that there was wrongdoing on both sides.
And I guess that's what I'm having trouble with. So, I mean, I read the magistrate judge's report. The magistrate judge's report clearly applies Knuth, goes through the factors, explains how at the end of the case, you know, attorney's fees are not warranted here. Then Judge Proctor reverses the magistrate judge. He adopts parts of the magistrate judge's order, but otherwise disagree with him. He seems to only cite the Tenth Circuit case as the basis for disagreeing with the magistrate judge. I don't see anywhere in Judge Proctor's order where he says that the magistrate judge got the application of the Knuth factors wrong. It just seems like he's saying that he is going to follow the Tenth Circuit. That's just the way.
Well, quite to the contrary. He says he adopts the magistrate judge's findings with respect to degree of success.
Right, but there is none, right? There's very little degree of success.
There's no success whatsoever. That's a given. That's a given. And that's why I made it clear that when looking at the two Knuth factors, you don't have to have success in order to get relief.
Absolutely.
That's what Judge Proctor said.
Right. Completely agree with you there. You don't have to have success to get relief, but that is one of the factors that we suggested you consider.
Yeah. Yes, sir. Most of sure.
You would also consider the respective culpability of the parties, and the magistrate judge said they're equally culpable. So I'm trying to find a factor that some judge considered that weighs in favor of giving the attorney's fees as opposed to against attorney's fees.
Yes, Your Honor. Culpability of the party is one of the considerations under the facts of the case, but it's not the only one. The serving of the public interest, that's a factor that may be considered. And Judge Wilkinson says so in the main case. And if Judge Proctor had simply said, instead of what he did say, if he had said, this court exercises its discretion to approve an award of attorney's fees and costs because the public purpose served by resolving the dispute justifies the recovery of fees. That would have covered him completely. It was a mistake for him to cite Gudenkauf for that language, because that same language is in a Fifth Circuit case, is in a Ninth Circuit case, is in a Seventh Circuit case, all of which are cited in my brief. So if it was unfortunate that the judge chose Gudenkauf rather than Shepard or Garcia or Norco, the language in any of those cases, but it does not detract from the fact that he actually considered, after having quoted Gudenkauf, which is presumptive, that should have been the end of it. But after he quoted it, he immediately went on to say that he's basing his decision on facts unique to this case. Your Honor, the judgment of the court, we believe, is amply supported by the record. We believe that the mistake of the judge in citing Gudenkauf, even though it didn't cite the presumptive language of Gudenkauf, we believe that even so, under the clear facts of this case, the judge considered both prongs of Canoe and exercised his discretion to grant an attorney's fee.
Thank you, sir. Ms. Wells, you may begin your rebuttal.
You're muted.
I'm very bad at Zoom. I'm very sorry. Thank you for telling me. Your Honor, thank you for allowing me my 3 minutes of rebuttal. I think it's important here to realize that we have an instance where the magistrate judge's report and recommendation, which included both factual analysis and findings and legal analysis and findings, was specifically adopted with respect to the injunctive and declaratory relief, and that portion was not appealed. Additionally, the court, instead of saying one way or the other, the district court didn't actually tell us if he was adopting or rejecting the factual findings in the R&R. He just rejected specifically the legal analysis, saying that to the extent that the magistrate judge recommends an award of attorney's fees and costs being dependent on a awarded declaratory injunctive relief or a finding of defendant's discrimination being blatant or egregious. That's what the court rejected. The district court read Magistrate Judge Borden's analysis of the Canup standards as requiring that and rejected that. So to the extent that Magistrate Judge Borden correctly summarized language that is in this court's binding precedent, that is where the district court judge began to go awry. And while he sets out the test that is Canup in his own articulation, if you'll see on, this is on page 4 of the district court's decision, he discusses 1, the degree of success obtained by the plaintiff, 2, the facts of the given case. Well, that's a key place where he could have said that the facts that inform that are the relative strength of evidence of the employee's misconduct motivating the decision or the employer's discrimination. It's not just any facts in the case. It's those particular ones, which he has not discussed anywhere here. And then he ends up with the third factor being the severity of the wrongdoing, which I would submit in Canup probably is part of the facts of the given case. So he does acknowledge that there's supposed to be, you know, that there are differences that drive the use of the discretion. And were this the correct application of Canup, I agree, all we would have is abuse of discretion, but because he got the test wrong here and fell into the misreading of the precedent and the policy that Gudenkauf exemplifies, and the cases that come after that make it really clear how Gudenkauf got that wrong, cases from other circuit courts of appeals. The problem is when you get to saying, for the word may to have meaning, you have to have a fee. Well, they have discretion to award a fee, but not automatically award a fee when there's not evidence under the test.
Thank you, counsel.
Sorry.
The court will be adjourned until 9 a.m. Central tomorrow morning.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor.